What was I going to say? I guess I first met David, God, more than 20 years ago now. And that time I was a young physicist, and I was, as most of us were, immediately impressed by David's intellect and his intuition, his good taste. And because I was young, I was more than a little bit intimidated by his lively style in seminars. But as we've worked together in this field, I find more and more that what I'm impressed with David as a physicist is his ability to be relentless. And sort of through thick and thin, when the field is lively and when it's boring, David is there relentlessly attacking the deepest questions, never letting up, always trying to get to the bottom of things. And as I get older and more tired, I admire that more and more. And so it's a pleasure for me to be able to be here and acknowledge and honor David's tremendous contribution to the progress in our subject. That being said, despite David's best efforts and the best efforts of the rest of us, those of us working in quantum gravity know that our field is a little bit stuck now. I'm old enough, and most of you are old enough to know that the field gets stuck every now and then, and it will get unstuck later on. The only thing it's hard to predict is when. I'm trying to think of a snappy reply, but I can't. maybe I'll miss your talk, though. So in a situation like that, it seems like it might be more useful and more entertaining, instead of talking about incremental results, to talk about directions of research, even if there aren't many results available. So I'm going to do that today. I'm going to talk about the things I'm struggling with without much in the way of hard results, in the hope that, well, it'll either point you toward or away these directions. Maybe the best I can do is to point you away from a quagmire that you might otherwise get yourself into. So I'm going to start with a litany that I have given a number of times. Those of you that have heard me talk in the last year or two are going to find it a lot familiar. And in certain backgrounds, we know what the rules of string M theory are. This is a great, important piece of progress we've made in our search and our study of quantum gravity. And it's very satisfying. These all come from brain bulk correspondences. We call them matrix theory or ADS-CFT or linear dilaton backgrounds. And all these descriptions are not fully satisfactory. That's probably an understatement. They're quite unsatisfactory. These descriptions suffer from a number of interrelated problems. First, they don't describe the most general and interesting situations we'd like to study. But let me put that aside. First, and Lenny beats my head against this all the time, is that locality is not manifest. For instance, at ADS-CFT, if you have an anti-de Sitter space represented by this ball, some local physics spaced by distance L, where L is much less than the characteristic anti-de Sitter radius, the physics describing this, encoded in the boundary theory, is completely delocalized. And the fact that physics here is nice and local, on macroscopic scales we're talking about, scales of a mile, is completely hidden in the formalism. And a related problem, background independence, is completely hidden. The constant modes that you might use to shift parameters in the theory are completely eliminated from these descriptions. And the way you get a different background is you change your Hamiltonian. Third, and in some ways, for me, I guess maybe the most irritating, although it's really closely related, these descriptions are not universal. The same local physics gets a very different coding depending on what geometry you're in, and hence what's at the boundary. If you have ADS 5 cross S 5, you code this little local physics in a four-dimensional Yang-Mills theory. If it's ADS 3 cross S 3, you code it in a two-dimensional conformal field theory. But it's the same local physics, and why should it have so many different names and descriptions? That, although it's not impossible, it's irritating. And in fact, this non-universality is inevitable when you have boundary holographic descriptions, because the boundary that encodes the local bulk physics, that encoding depends on the projection through all that intervening geometry. And it will certainly depend on that intervening geometry. Well, so this motivates a search for an alternative formulation. These formulations are valid, they're just not, they just don't make certain things clear. You might try to implement holography by a local bulk formulation, where degrees of freedom live in the bulk, not the boundary, with, let's say, a large gauge symmetry and or strong equations of motion that reduce the physical degrees of freedom to those on the boundary. And a number of us have fitfully tried to explore such ideas. The analogy might be Chern-Simons theory, where you have a bulk theory. I realize B stands for boundary late last night, but you'll have to, B is bulk. You have this bulk theory, there's a boundary, and the boundary theory is some conformal field theory. And gauge invariance and equations of motion eliminate these bulk degrees of freedom in favor of the boundary degrees of freedom. Probably more realistic, with a little more stuff going on, is to consider a covariant string field theory, say closed string field theory, where the degrees of freedom are defined in the bulk. The fields live everywhere in the bulk. And you can gauge fix, at least in low orders and perturbation theory it's been shown, to light cone string field theory, where the degrees of freedom are defined on a transverse slice. Here, locality, although I get into arguments about this every now and then, is probably more manifest than it would be. And here, locality is not manifest, but the degree of freedom count is better. So these might be sort of hints that such a formalism is not crazy. If you could have such a formalism, it would have real utility in addition to making situations that we understand more transparent. You might be able to study situations without asymptotic boundaries, like in cosmology. The analogy might be that Chern-Simons theory can be defined on a manifold without a boundary at all. So similarly, if you have such a bulk formalism, you might be able to define it in more general situations. There are a huge number of constraints such a formalism must obey, though. D-brains must contain many degrees of freedom, since if you pack a lot of them together, they blow up space to make a much larger bulk region. So you have to have the stuff around to describe that bulk, that local dynamics. In a local description, you must be able to deal with horizons, not being just out of the horizon, but passing through. So you must understand the physics, quote unquote, inside the horizon, and probably physics gauge related to physics that's outside. This is a lot of stuff to get straight, and for me, at least, seems like a tall order. So I've been struggling with this without a lot of success. And recently, I've undertaken what I think of as a tactical retreat. Although I don't know much military history, but my guess is when most commanders describe what they're doing as a tactical retreat, it really means they're in a rout and they're running as fast as they can away from the conflict. Well, I won't pursue that further. So I wanted to study a possibly simpler context to address these issues, and that's the issue of black hole entropy. Okay, there's this famous formula due to Hawking and Bekenstein, that the entropy of a black hole is equal to the area divided by 4 in Planck units. And the universality of this formula is just amazing. Okay, it applies in every situation we can imagine in gravitational physics. In string physics, of course, G Newton is related to G string squared, and so this is a contribution of order 1 over G string squared. It occurs at the level of the sphere, a tree level contribution. One of the great successes of the recent progress we've made in string theory is that there are beautiful explanations for this entropy in certain situations involving brains. Okay? These explanations are also not fully satisfactory. Okay? For one, the locality in certain senses is not manifest. The black hole entropy is proportional to the area of the horizon. Okay? I think any of us, the first time we look at that formula, says, oh, that's easy to understand. You have a horizon, and you have some local stuff on it, and so the entropy is extensive. Okay, that seems like the easiest part of the formula to understand. And all the known ways of calculating this, that's completely obscured. Okay? The answer comes out correct, but for non-obvious reasons, I guess is the polite way to say it. Again, these counts are non-universal. You can embed essentially the same black hole in many different brain constructions and get the same count out of many different degrees of freedom. So again, in the same way that we discussed earlier, one might be led to try to find an alternate explanation that doesn't satisfy, doesn't have these defects. Well, unlike in the case of, a reformulation of everything, use a phrase somebody here likes. There's an idea due to Lenny and John Oglem, his student, that takes us a little bit toward such an explanation of black hole entropy. Let's think about the situation they discussed, large mass Schwarzschild in flat space, where the near horizon limit looks like Rindler space. And let's talk about Euclidean space. So Rindler space is just a plane, the R T Euclidean plane. Rindler time is the polar coordinate here. And other coordinates along the horizon, if you have, say, a two-sphere, would be tensored onto this. Now, the fact that Euclidean time is periodic suggests that you have an effective temperature. And if you're parked a distance r away from the horizon, the effective beta goes like r, that's the circumference of the circle. The effective temperature goes like 1 over r. So the closer you are to the horizon, the higher the temperature an observer feels. And so you have this picture of a hot layer at what is called a stretched horizon, just above the true horizon. And then these authors gave an analogy, or a picture that I like. They say, imagine instead of fundamental string theory, you have some Yang-Mills strings. We sort of know these are not unrelated to each other, okay? And you imagine these Yang-Mills strings near this hot region. We know Yang-Mills strings, when they get hot, fall into gluons, okay? Now, if I turn this plane on its side, this is now the RT plane, this is a piece of the horizon. Close to R equals zero, you have a hot environment that these strings dissolve into gluons on. So you have this gluon gas coating the horizon, and these strings kind of emerging, looping like this. You have N squared gluons, so you might expect an entropy from these little tail pieces that goes like N squared, which is 1 over G string squared. And this string can move up and down the horizon, and so this hot gas has an extensive entropy, which will give you something times the area of the horizon. Okay, what could be simpler? So this is appealing. And like a lot of Lenny's ideas, it's very appealing but deceptively complicated and frustrating to understand in detail. Now, this explanation is related to other ideas that sort of fall outside the brain explanation. They're related to ideas of induced gravity, where the actual coefficient of Einstein's term comes from integrating out some degrees of freedom. And entropy of entanglement. Instead of thinking of those half strings as dissolving on the horizon, you can think of them describing a hidden half of a string behind the horizon. Hawking, Maldacena, and Strominger have done some interesting work recently along these lines. But of course, these ideas need to be thought about more carefully. One reason why you see that is that this flat space of Rindler space is just flat space. So any sort of coordinate independent description of strings propagating here isn't going to give you some weird deconfining transition of gluons. It's just going to give you strings propagating in flat space. So you got to be a little bit more subtle than that. Well, Susskind and Uglem thought about a way to be more subtle. And they ask, what in fact is the response? Well, what did I do with it? I guess it was on here. They said, let's use the thermodynamic identity that the entropy is related to the change of the free energy with respect to temperature. So you change the temperature by changing beta, the radius of the polar circle, a little bit. And that means in flat space, if you change the radius of these circles, you turn a plane into a cone. And so you develop a conical singularity, and the smaller delta beta is, the shallower this cone. And so you can understand the entropy by asking, what is the response of string theory to an infinitesimal conical singularity? Infinitesimal because you're taking a derivative. Well, unfortunately, we don't yet know how to compute this directly in string theory. In caricature, it's something like the sphere diagram with a one-point function of this conical curvature singularity. It's got to be a one-point function because it's a first derivative. Okay, and it's of order 1 over g squared. So rather than figure out what this picture means, they pursued another indirect argument. I'll skip this next discussion, which says we look at the effective action for gravity in string theory, which is given by Einstein's action plus corrections, and we ask, what's the response of this action to putting in a small conical curvature singularity? And this actually essentially reduces to the Gibbons-Hawking derivation of entropy, and so in fact you get the correct formula for the black hole entropy. Now, you might think this is a little cheap, but I think it's provocative because the picture is very suggestive. And so I think It occurs that what we need to do is we need to sharpen it up, and we need to find a place where we really can compute in a well-defined string theory such a process. And that's the goal that we'll have for ourselves. Now, if we could get a picture like this straight, it would have some utility in addition to explaining known facts. For instance, suppose string theory could be defined in De Sitter space, as a number of people have been discussing recently. Then the entropy in the region discussed by Tom, this cavity that an observer sees this cavity having a hot horizon on it. So this observer would then figure out what entropy he or she is seeing by saying, oh, there are these half strings coating the horizon, and they are the things that account for the entropy. So again, in more complicated situations that are hard to construct by brain arrays, you might be able to account for the entropy. Of course, this picture would have nothing to say about whether or not string theory is consistent in De Sitter space. So in some sense, it's much less because it doesn't sort of impose from the beginning a complete non-perturbative formalism, but it's also more flexible. So we can now raise the question, can we find a completely well-posed formalism to explore these ideas? Well, the only well-posed formalisms we have for dealing with string theory are these brain bulk type systems. So we're probably going to have to choose one of these. In order to see these strings on the horizon, and Lenny's ideas are formulated in the context of weakly coupled string theory, we need to have the strings manifest. And in most of these brain bulk situations, like the ADS-CFT correspondences, although we are morally sure that the strings are there, we don't know how to find them. We don't know how to display them. Okay. So most of these brain bulk correspondences are not useful. The matrix string is one important case where the strings are quite visible. Unfortunately, this light cone frame where matrix strings are defined is not well suited to thinking in Euclidean signature. So I couldn't find a way to use that, although maybe there's a way to think there about this process as well. So this leaves just one possibility that I know of, which are what are called, affectionately I hope, old matrix models. Okay. And this is another reason I thought it'd be fun to talk about this, since David and I and many other people in this room spent a good deal of time a decade ago or so looking at these models. Again, the idea here is you have matrix degrees of freedom, typically a one-dimensional field theory, the quantum mechanics of matrices, M is an N by N matrix. The Feynman diagrams of this theory will look like this. They make fishnet type diagrams that approximate the world sheet. This theory, as we understood, is an early example of a holographic theory. You have the Lagrangian or action for this matrix quantum mechanics that lives on one dimension. You can think about it as time. And dynamically, an extra dimension is generated, which in the continuum we call the Liouville direction. Okay, so you really are describing a string in two dimensions here. Okay. Now, because you can calculate a great deal in these models, okay, the field theory is very simple. It's just a matrix quantum mechanics that reduces to a theory of free fermions. You can calculate a lot, and that allows one to partially, I guess in Lenny's language, decode the hologram and understand some of what's happening as a function of the Liouville coordinate in terms of the matrix degrees of freedom. So this is a possible place where we might be able to, on the one hand, examine the strings because we have these fishnet diagrams, on the second hand, have a non-perturbative formalism, this matrix quantum mechanics, and see how the entropies line up using two different ways of calculation. Well, maybe the first thing we try, and it was tried a lot 10 years ago, is to make black holes in high-energy collisions in these low-dimensional string theories. Depressingly, black holes refuse to form, okay, despite many people's best efforts. And I'm not sure if the situation is completely understood, but one, I think, reason that you may not be able to make black holes is these theories are integrable, and they don't, when you bang stuff together, you don't equilibrate a lot of the energy into sort of random thermal states. But in any event, empirically it's true that you can't take a model in a more or less flat, not really flat, but in a rather generic background, bang together a lot of stuff and make a black hole. That doesn't seem to happen. There is a two-dimensional black hole classical solution, which I guess we can call Witten's cigar. Do you want to veto that name? Okay. When you calculate what's known to be calculable, you don't find black holes come out. Say that again.
Well, the situations that you're contemplating are ones to throw something together
that you would expect. Oh, would expect. Yes, would expect. Yes. Well, you put a classically large amount of energy in, and yeah.
Is the issue that you run into the Kakiel potential in that sense?
No. So why doesn't it happen? All right, so one explanation is they're free fermions. Black holes are thermal objects. You know, they don't thermalize. I'm sorry? A semi-classical explanation? I don't know what that is. I don't know. The Witten cigar, you mean. Right. I don't know. In the absence, I mean, yes. Right.
Now, if you want to make a black hole, you'd like it to be characterized by energy and not by other charges. So it's just producing thermal ensemble. It seems to me that one hypothesis is that if you send in, for example, 7 3 fermions in this state,
yeah,
you create a state with some additional charges. So it's not together by a black hole, but by some black holes with some chemical chemicals that we're not used to. You can characterize another energy system. If that's our definition, it might be that you can make a black hole without additional chemical chemicals. You have to send in.
I don't know. I don't even know if that can be done, though. I mean, you can put the thing in a thermal bath and shoot in a bunch of energy. I don't know if that.
Well, clearly, over a period of several months, you send a thermal ensemble function with the right characteristics and that hot radiation that you can.
Yeah.
So we get that hot radiation to a black hole. Have you compared initial state to a black hole?
Can we call that state the Witten's second cigar? Witten's hairy cigar will be the one.
Well, this is an attempt, I guess, yeah, to reconcile.
Right, I understand. I think maybe the right thing to do I remember vaguely from a decade ago, these were very painful discussions. So I think maybe I will put aside this particular issue for a little while and go on with what I think can be done. And then this deeper question will have to get resolved to tighten the story up. All right. But as we said, there is a two-dimensional black hole classical solution, which in Euclidean space looks like this. The Rindler space we were talking about is the local tip environment. Now, because it turns out that the radius of this thing is not that large in string units, this isn't almost Rindler, but it has the same qualitative features. And sort of the reason that I'm giving this talk is there's been recent progress. It now is possible, although for many years it wasn't understood how, to study string dynamics in this cigar background using these techniques of the old matrix model. And this is work of Kazakov, Kostov, and Kutuzov. Okay. So this gives us a way of seeing these whorl shapes moving on a Euclidean black hole background and maybe seeing I'm getting hung up on something like a conical singularity. And so maybe we can watch these things happen. You'll remember that the pictures I was talking about, you know, conical singularities and stuff, didn't get at some of the deeper issues like black hole formation and decoherence and things like that. So in some sense, we're talking at a much lower level of analysis. And it would be nice if we could break the problem up like that. The key to being able to do this was being able to map the cigar, which is some two-dimensional sigma model, into another more manageable sigma model, the so-called Sine-Liouville model. And this map was conjectured by Fateyev and the Zamolodnikov brothers based on certain calculational results. And the Sine-Liouville model is you have a two-dimensional field theory. You have a scalar field that's periodic, the period R. And then you have a Liouville field, and instead of having the usual cosmological constant, You have cosine of the winding number of this compact field times a Liouville dressing to make it 1-1, plus the usual linear dilaton term. Okay. And the claim is, for an appropriate choice of parameters, this model and the cigar are quantum equivalent as sigma models. How much time do I have? 5 minutes? What do I got? I might take 10, but that's not enough. Now, let's talk a little bit about the identification of couplings. One immediate thing is the Sine-Liouville model, which just involved a compact scalar field, is defined for any value of R. That means if it's quantum equivalent, that somehow the cigar should be defined for any value of R. So we're seeing that there must be some way of deforming this cigar to have different values of R. That's already interesting and strange. The cigar we're interested in has a radius of 3/2 in string unit. The other parameter describing the cigar is the mass of the black hole, which is related by what used to be called, I guess it's still called double scaling, another one of David's coinages, which I must say I never liked. It's scaling, it's not double scaling. Okay. Which is the coupling constant at the tip of the cigar. Okay. And these map at this spectral value of the radius to this, the coefficient of that Sine-Liouville term to the 1/8. You can solve the Sine-Liouville sigma model as a string background to any order in string perturbation theory by matrix techniques. This is what KKK did. I was thinking that I really should rename this using their first names or something. But then I realized the three of my experimental colleagues at Stanford, Kapitolnik, Javal, and Beasley, call their group the KGB group. And they've been very successful. And in fact, Mac Beasley was a couple years ago made dean at Stanford. Now maybe he was made dean because of this, the name of this group, I don't know. So I decided that they could live with the... K3 is good, yeah. Okay, yeah, that probably, okay. Well, you can choose. In fact, many results about this system can be obtained from the old C equals 1 results, T-dualing the winding number perturbation into a momentum perturbation, and then these power series were summed by Moore. This perturbation creates a vortex, and David and Igor Klebanov first taught us about vortices in these low-dimensional matrix models. And the picture, then, is that this cigar, where this tip of the cigar prevents stuff from going further, is mapped into this Liouville direction, which goes infinitely far, but then you have a condensate of winding number modes, of vortices, and the condensate builds up so strongly that it prevents anything from penetrating into it. So somehow the effect of this cigar tip is represented by a lot of vortices. This is not crazy because the cigar does not conserve winding number. You can slip a wrapped string off the tip of it. So this is related to having vortices that tell you you don't conserve winding number. And so the symmetries seem to be the same. And so you might try to argue for this quantum equivalence by saying, what else could it be? Of course, these two things are the same. I think that's probably a little unfair. All right, we can ask for the entropy. Now, again, the Sine-Liouville model is defined for any R, so we can differentiate with respect to the temperature, with respect to R, and we can find its entropy. This vortex perturbation, its correlation functions depend on the radius because of this explicit periodicity. So you will get an explicit contribution at tree level to the entropy. Okay, these vortices wind around the X direction, and so at tree level, there's a response to varying R. And so the entropy goes like 1 over G string squared, and as Igor and David explained, this dependence is due to the non-singlet states. In this matrix MAB, you have n squared components. All these n squared components roughly get activated, giving you an entropy proportional to n squared. So in some sense, in this picture, the black hole entropy comes from all these different matrix components. The perturbative strings just come from this FUN singlet states. Okay. So far, it seems like we're rolling. This is just with the doctor order. So again, to compute the entropy, you would roughly take df dr, where r is the temperature. That hits one of these vortex operators on the sheet, varies its r, and that gives you a one-point function, very much like the conical singularity one-point function, although it's not really a conical singularity here. Now, the formula you get for the free energy on the sphere from matrix model techniques is given by this answer as a function of r. Again, notice this model is perfectly well-defined as a function of r. In fact, this power just comes from scaling, the famous scaling called KPZ scaling. Okay. At the black hole radius, the free energy goes like lambda to the eighth. And in one of the interesting observations of the K3 paper, they say, well, this must be the same as zero, because this is analytic in lambda and accounts for, let's say, the presence of just eight vortices. We're familiar from the old days that things that are analytic in the various parameters often are related to non-universal short-distance physics. So this seems like a reasonable suggestion to say this is equivalent to zero. If you have a free energy that's equivalent to zero, a little thought tells you that that's consistent with having an entropy that's proportional to energy. I didn't write it out here, but the free energy is E minus TS, and 1 over T is DS DE. Putting those deep facts together, you find that the free energy is zero whenever you have this relation. So this seems to be consistent with an entropy proportional to energy, identifying as the energy as the mass. You find the entropy should be proportional to the mass. Our expectation from doing the classical black hole thermodynamics is the entropy is proportional to this particular number times the mass. So that seems to be a success. And the mass here is interpreted as lambda to the eighth because it shows up also as the loop counting parameter, the coupling constant in the theory. But things are a little bit stickier than that, because now we can try to compute the entropy from df dt, differentiating this formula with respect to r. And you find something that goes like lambda to some power log lambda, which turns into mass to some power log mass. And this doesn't make much sense. And so there seems to be something wrong with what the most naive manipulations here. And this is where things get confusing. So I think in order to unravel the situation, we need to dig deeper. And here, I'm afraid I won't have anything positive to report. I'll just tell you what tools we have to try to sort this out. The first thing I think we need to understand is, what is this R variation on the cigar side? Is it like a conical singularity, or is it, what is it? We have no reliable answers yet, but we have some tools. Recently, Hori and Kapustin have used the Hori-Vafa presentation of mirror symmetry to map the supersymmetric cigar with n equals 2 world sheet symmetry via their mirror map to the Sine-Liouville supersymmetric map. Okay. This maps a cigar of radius r, because mirror is kind of like t-duality, to a Sine-Liouville model with radius 1 over r and a momentum perturbation. What's required then, I think, to get the FZZ map is to do a second t-duality on the low energy theory, which turns r to 1 over r and cosine x into cosine of the winding number. So then FZZ is this diagonal on the diagram. So we can then think about what changing R is here, climbing back through the dualities, and see if we can get some insight. This is harder because changing the radius involves changing the kinetic terms, the D terms, which are under much poorer control in a supersymmetric field theory. But maybe it's not hopeless. Another thing we have going for us that we may hear about tomorrow is that recently a much better understanding of the spectrum of SL2 has been developed due to Maldacena and Oguri, and since the cigar can be presented as an SL2 mod U1 coset, we should be able to have a finer understanding of what perturbations are allowed. So, well, I won't, there's a fantasy about what might be happening, but I think it's sufficiently unreliable that we don't have to talk about it now. So let me conclude by saying what will happen. Hopefully we can get all this straight. And we have a picture of the Susskind-Uglum scenario that we can verify quantitatively and see the microscopic degrees of freedom. And then what do we do? Well, the first thing is to try to get away from D equals 2. Matrix techniques don't work above D equals 2 for well-understood reasons. But in fact, as you can see from what I've said, all we really need is the FZZ map and basically KPZ scaling, plus a little work on the sigma model to get the coefficient right, in order to compute the tree entropy correctly. So we should be able to compute, for instance, the entropy of the five brain, which is a cigar, tensor, some other stuff, using ideas very much like this. We then have to think of getting away from this, a rather highly curved cigar. We have to go to the large R, Rindler limit, where the cigar is very fat. Okay. Well, then the winding operator is a very high dimension operator. The mass of the winding string is enormous. And so the sigma model becomes sort of what you might call non-renormalizable. Even though the perturbation is really dimension one, it's like string theory where you can always make a mass of string state dimension one because of the negative metric time direction. So the sigma model is difficult to control. But nonetheless, it seems from these mirror map ideas that there's some map between a strongly coupled sigma model with lots of high derivative operators is mirrored to something that's almost flat space. Now we know that you often can take a weakly curved manifold and mirror it and get something with a lot of curvature in it. And then I guess what you'd hope is that the radius variation in the strongly coupled sigma model, which is manifest, would somehow mock up this conical deficit perturbation dressed up appropriately to make it sensible in string theory. I don't know how that's going to happen. More generally, things we'd have to improve on, the Susskind-Ugland picture is tied to strings. What happens to the M-theory limit? I mean, you know, this formula works everywhere. What's the explanation for black holes in 11-dimensional theory? Suppose you don't, it also is tied to Rindler horizons. What happens if you look at other horizons, like the kind that are in extremal black holes? And even at last, what will happen if this description works? What will we learn? And I was thinking about this late last night, and I realized the only way I could think of saying it is in the reverse. If such a description doesn't work, and we can really identify a generic obstruction to it, I think it would sound the death knell to these bulk local pictures of string theory. And so if it does work, I don't think it will give us much information about the degrees of freedom we need, because this entropy is so generic and so universal. So I guess I'm interested in pursuing the program to make sure this negative does not happen. And if it doesn't, then we can go back from there and stop retreating. Thank you. I must not have gone fast enough, I'm sorry.
Yes. And I was thinking at that time that maybe some interesting clues can be found in the context of what I was speaking about. So you have Kurt Simon's term,
yes,
written as total derivative.
Yes.
Therefore, they all contribute to the bound.
Right.
On the other hand, you know they contribute to the equation of both and local.
Right.
So all of that is consistent, and working that out may have some.
Yeah, I think that would be interesting, and I think there are related questions about certain kinds of conformal field theories seem to be described by Bulk-Chern-Simons theories, and certain kind are described by these fancier string theories. And you know, what kind of conformal field theory is best described by what is an open question, at least to me. So I think there is more to do there.
Hey, I understand correctly that you have difficulty with changing the temperature of the cigar.
Yeah, all right, yeah.
Actually, I think David can help you with that. I talked with him yesterday, and he can solve that problem for you.
I'm sorry?
He can solve the problem for you, David.
Great.
I happen to have a human cigar. Human cigar, and he can change the temperature for you.
Can't do it in here.